I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When a prison has a growing number of inmates and a shrinking number of guards, sooner or later, there's gonna be trouble. Today, a conversation addressing the current problems with the Jackson County Jail. We'll ask about the plans county legislators will continue working on when they meet later on today. Then, a different look at journalism. It's no secret that the internet is a challenge for traditional media outlets when it comes to revenue, but for digital trailblazers, it is a cherished resource. We'll learn how new technology can help journalists tell a more immersive story. After that, the latest in sports with Greg Ecklin. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The problems with the Jackson County Jail can be boiled down to just a few words: too many inmates and not enough guards. The legislature and County Executive Frank White are trying to figure out next steps. In fact, they'll meet at 2:30 today at the courthouse in Independence to discuss a series of potential short-term solutions. Last week, attorneys filed a class action lawsuit alleging dirty and dangerous conditions at the jail. With us now are a pair of Jackson County legislators to give us an update on a jail that's causing a whole lot of problems. Crystal Williams is a 2nd District at-large legislator. Crystal, nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
Dan Tarwater is a 4th District legislator. Dan, good morning to you.
Thank you, Steve.
Give us some more detail, Crystal, if you would, on what the legislature will be focusing on today.
The legislative chair, Scott Burnett, sent a letter to County Executive Frank White asking for some detailed plans, short-term, I believe it was just short-term plans in the letter, addressing some of the more crucial aspects of problems in the jail.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there were a lot of meetings last week. I talked to Scott Burnett this morning.
He's the county legislative chairman.
He's the chair. Yeah, we rotate yearly and elect amongst ourselves. And he said that there's going to be discussion today about things like changing the visitation hours, working with the court to reduce add-ons, which is adding an inmate on to another previously planned inmate excursion across to maybe the courthouse and things like that, because evidently that takes a lot of time. Increasing video visitation, giving people that opportunity as opposed to coming into the jail, because visitations do take you've got to move people and things like that. I'm heartened that these things are being discussed and that they're moving forward with them. I guess I'm less heartened that all of these things seem to more or less affect inmates, but I don't know how much they're going to address a lot of the underlying issues.
Dan, what do you make of this? Does this begin to address the concerns the legislature has when it comes to needs for short-term solutions?
I would say no, not totally. These are needs that we have, but we need to look at the fundamental issues, which seems to be right now a management issue. We're very top-heavy. We need more guards. The guards that we have in there are doing a great job for the most part. But what we need to do is concentrate on running the jail correctly. There are a number of issues that can be done, farming out the transport over to the courts. That would free up 35 jail guards, put them back on the floors. When you look at the structure itself, you have Frank White, but you have Caleb Clifford right underneath him that has no jail experience. Then you have Gary, who has no jail experience.
The county administrator, yeah.
And then you have 5 or 6 different people that are on the next level. We need more people that are in there that are doing their job. We need a structure right.
Dan Tarwater, this notion you mentioned, transferring the transport responsibilities over to the court, meaning they would have to hire guards to do some transportation, or explain
no,
that
no,
one
no,
to
no.
me.
No. We're not transferring anything over to the court. Right now we have a private entity that is doing some of it. The rest of it is all done by the, you know, by the jail guards. So we may look at transferring all of it to those, you know, to the outside, or to the sheriff's department, you know, to do the transport.
There was actually talk last week, Crystal Williams, about shutting down one floor of the Jackson County Jail as a way to free up more guards and to spread the responsibility of overseeing inmates to fewer people here. Is that still on the table here? Because that would involve housing inmates on the floor that's closed in some kind of temporary facility.
I hope not. I don't know. I wasn't part of those discussions last week. We've let the chair and the vice chair sort of represent the legislature at those discussions thus far until today. I certainly hope not, because really, far you would almost have to send those inmates to other counties, other jails. I've been told that that's problematic now, since we had some inmates that were in another county recently and there were problems occurring between the inmates that we sent there and the ones that were already there. I mean, we are talking about ways to ease the crowding using maybe temporary structures. There are companies that actually do that. And we need to delve further into that conversation, but there's a good chance that we have inmates that are candidates for being in maybe a temporary mobile structure kind of situation, and it would maybe free up some of the crowding issues, which I'm glad that you did bring that up, because the crowding as well as the guards, those two things kind of are going hand in hand also.
You know, the consultant that you guys hired to look at all this was unequivocal about the situation up in the jail right now, Dan. You know, he said it's a crisis situation. That's what's going on right now. Given that, do you anticipate the legislature will be making decisions today or this week to address some of these short-term concerns, and then perhaps having a conversation later on this month about longer-term considerations?
The reason that we had him before the open body, because we had been talking to him in private sessions. He kept sounding the alarm. We kept having problems, and there was no movement. So we wanted to get that out into the public of we have to do something. So what he pointed out was, with his 30 years of experience, he'd never seen anything as bad as what we have here. He'd closed some jails before. In our case, it couldn't, you know, can't do that because we actually have to have it. There have been some changes made to the cleanliness. It's still not 100% there. But the number one concern is the safety. And people say, well, they're inmates. They're actually there waiting to go to trial, so not all of them, you know, are definitely guilty people. But it's the safety of the citizens of Jackson County, because we can't have these people reaching out to the outside world, you know, with their cell phones and other things that, that they're getting somehow in there. Because then you can intimidate witnesses, you can do a lot of other things, so it's not isolated to people that are in, you know, in, that are incarcerated.
You know, Crystal Williams, if we're going to cut through the clutter here, it sounds like what's happening is the legislature, or at least the majority of the legislature, is making a concerted push here to nudge County Executive Frank White to begin to take some action here. Am I seeing that correctly? Is that where we're at here?
I would temper that a bit. Okay. Frank White has been expressing concern about the jail since he took office. He has cared greatly about it. I think he's taken the advice of the people that work for him and are tasked with running the jail. I think that we just, you know, we all work together on this. The sheriff is concerned about this. The prosecutor's concerned about it. The courts are concerned. I think that we've all come together to work to address it. As I told you, I think when we talked last week, unfortunately, the legislature doesn't have appropriating authority. We cannot initiate a fiscal, an appropriations bill to lay out money to address the very serious issues.
But the county executive can.
Does, correct. Mm-hmm. So us working together is the key to getting this fixed. And though, yes, he does, you know, the purview of running the jail falls within the executive branch, The jail is a core function of Jackson County. We are all responsible for this, and we all need to work together to fix it.
But along those lines, Dan Tarwater, the sheriff that Crystal just alluded to, Mike Sharp, he has raised his hands in frustration at a meeting at the legislature 10 days ago and asked a very pointed question, which was, where's the urgency here? And he was frustrated with that, and I'm wondering what you have to say to that.
We as legislators have all been concerned with that, and mm-hmm. so we are all pushing for that urgency. And as Crystal said, Frank is a very good man. In this situation, maybe he's listening to some other people that don't want the urgency there, don't want the issue. By closing your eyes does not make this situation go away. So therefore, we have to address it. We have to address it, by raising some pay with the guards and making some other changes internally.
Dan, Frank White was just asked on KSHB TV if he believes the jail's in crisis. And he said, hey, it's in a better place today than it was 2 years ago. So who's right? Is the jail in crisis or is it in a better place than it was 2 years ago?
I think all you have to do is look at the reports that are coming out of there. You still have assaults. You still have narcotics. You still have contraband. You still have other things that are going through that jail. It's a management issue. We need to stop that stuff right away and get better control over radios and other things that are missing in the jail. Keys.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking with two Jackson County legislators, Crystal Williams and Dan Tarwater, about the Jackson County Detention Center, a jail very much in crisis these days, and how the legislature is going to address it. The sheriff, again, Mike Sharp, Crystal, has asked aloud how the situation was allowed to deteriorate to this point. How do you answer that question?
Well, I mean, it didn't happen overnight, and it didn't just happen in the last 2 years under Frank White's tenure.
It's a longer-term problem.
A lot of the deterioration appears to have happened over a number of years. I mean, let's be clear. A lot of people don't become super sympathetic about the jail. A lot of people think that it's just a drag. It's a drag to talk about. It's a drag to fund. Yet it is a crucial core function. It is about safety. If the inmates are not in a safe environment, if they've got cell phones, it adds to the chaos in our streets. If you've got people that are awaiting trial that are talking on their cell phones, stirring things up back in the neighborhood, that can be a very serious issue. Mm-hmm. So it's a big deal. And a lot, you never know when someone you know may end up in there. People need to understand how important this really is.
If our listeners have a quick question, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Dan, how do you respond to this question of how the situation was allowed to deteriorate to this point?
Well, I know, every time that the executive side came to us for money to try to fix things, we were always there for them. So we as a legislative body want it fixed. Crystal is right. It didn't happen in the last...
Push that button. Yeah, there you go.
It didn't happen in the last 2 years. This is something that's been going on for a little while, but as deterioration happens, it's a slippery slope, and it's become much worse over the last couple of years.
Crystal, I've talked to public defenders. I've written columns about this for the newspaper, public defenders who go to the jail regularly and have inmates for clients there. They tell stories of panic buttons not working, of guards not responding to calls. This strikes me as a problem with the basics here. When you hear stories like that, what goes through your mind?
Well, I guess I have to say what goes through my mind is what Dan has mentioned a couple of times. The management is not working. The current management matrix isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to pick on anyone. It's a fact. And honestly, I lie awake at night worrying about that place.
I was just going to ask you. You said that before publicly.
I couldn't sleep last night. Mm-hmm. I literally worry about the guards, the people that are in there. I worry about the attorneys that go in there, from the prosecutors and the public defenders. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, and a lot of those attorneys are women, and we've had some really disturbing things happen in there, including rape.
You know, you mentioned you're concerned about the management of the jail. The management, the current operation, as I understand it, fairly new here, new management of the jail. But is it time for a change?
I don't really know how new it is, honestly, because I believe that currently the same people are at the top that were there under the previous county executive. Mm-hmm. So that's not that new.
Is it time for a change?
I believe so. And it's not the place of the legislature to tell them how to do the staffing, but it is our place to question the spending of appropriations in the current way that we're doing it. I think you've probably heard me say that, you know, the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect a different outcome.
And that's what's happening with the jail, you're saying.
That's what it appears to from where we stand. Now, obviously, we're not involved in the day-to-day management of the facility, but we continue to hear about guards and other people telling us how unsafe they feel. We have had people quit because they don't feel safe.
Mm-hmm. Dan Tarwater, Crystal Williams just said that she'd like to see new management at the jail. Would you?
Yes, I would. I would like to see that also. That's really the only way that you're going to see a change. If we built a new jail and we moved the structure that we have back over to a brand new facility, we'd be in the same situation that we're in today. So therefore, we do have to change that. The other thing that we might look at is maybe even calling the Missouri attorney to do an audit.
Missouri auditor, you're saying?
The auditor, yes. Mm-hmm. Call the auditor in, because we're paying all these exorbitant overtime hours, all these other things, which is, you know, some state money involved there also, to get a good look at what is happening over there.
In Jackson County government, Dan, who makes the decision to change the management of the Jackson County Detention Center?
We can push for it, but ultimately the directors and other people are hired by the executive side. We do have the power to say no, but we do not have the power to actually hire.
Just one last question before you both go. There's also been some preliminary talk, very preliminary, about the need for a new jail at some point down the road. Your consultant has said that's a decision you don't want to rush into. Crystal Williams, where are you at when it comes to the need for a new jail?
I think that it's something that needs to be looked at very seriously. I probably have a tendency to believe that that's where we're heading. But again, you certainly don't make that decision lightly. There has to be a lot of public discussion over that issue.
$300-400 million expenditure.
Absolutely.
If we go that direction.
Absolutely.
Big money. Let's go to a phone call here. Sue from Brookside. Sue, you're on Up to Date.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. Old people are human beings. The inmates are human beings. They could be our son or our daughter, and we must treat them humanely. And thank you for your comment on that, Crystal.
Okay, thank you, Sue, for the phone call. We're going to leave our conversation there. Crystal Williams, a 2nd District at-large legislator. Dan Tarwater, a 4th District legislator. I'll probably see you out in Independence this afternoon for the hearing, okay?
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Both very much. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics dramatically. We're going to talk about the need for a new way to look at reporting stories and American journalism. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday, we learned about the Muslim American experience in the Trump administration. Also, we spoke with piano legend Herbie Hancock. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. On tomorrow's program, we preview more of the discussions going on at TEDxKC, learn how folk wisdom and neuroscience are working together, and we hear how we can have it all. We just can't have it all perfectly. That's later on this week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the World Wide Web has been a double-edged blade for journalism. It has some traditional outlets struggling to retain audience numbers and finding ways to make their digital content pay. On the plus side, the internet allows for a delivery of content that can make the consumer feel in the moment. Yet there is still so much to be done at the intersection of technology and journalism, and that's what Robert Hernandez works toward every day. He's an associate professor of professional practice at USC Annenberg as an at-web journalist, He co-founded at WJ Chat, a weekly Twitter forum, and is one of the true veterans of web journalism. Robert Hernandez will present at the TEDxKC event on Friday, but this morning he joins us from the campus of the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. I should point out he joins us by Skype. Robert, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
The theme for this year's TEDxKC is Perspective, Where You Stand Matters. And that is very fitting for you because you teach the use of both augmented reality and virtual reality that can give the audience a sense of standing in the story. What is augmented reality and how is it different from virtual reality?
Great. Yeah, that's exactly what I talk about. And virtual reality, how I define it, is leaving this reality to immerse ourselves completely into another reality. Could be created by videos or pixel by pixel 3D models, computer graphics, but we leave this reality and immerse ourselves into another reality. Augmented reality is staying within our reality, but using digital assets to augment our current experience, adding videos and text overlays in our current reality.
You know, is the idea to make the story a more immersive experience, is that aimed at the consumer then?
Well, the goal of journalism is to give context about the community around you, right? Using information to give you a better perspective of how to vote or what's happening with your tax dollars or even where to go eat. And so this type of technology is just the next evolutionary step of how we use our phones and other types of content to make us have better decisions. So augmented reality allows you to look at a building and find out, say a restaurant, and find out the health code violations, or if your friends recommend it. Or you can look at a corner and see if the pothole's been fixed. It's using data and information and putting it in context to where you are. So it's another level of perspective and another level of context. Virtual reality allows you to immerse yourself into a story. In your previous segment, you talked about the county jail.
Right.
Well, I've never been there, thank God. but I can understand that perspective through virtual reality and see solitary confinement and the conditions that jail finds itself in through these experiences to really, really reach a news consumer, a community member in another level, far beyond text, photos, audio, or video.
That's interesting. How labor-intensive is preparing a VR story? Because your students produced Hell and High Water, a virtual reality piece that runs about 11 and a half minutes. How long did it take to create that thing?
Well, that was in partnership with ProPublica that did a fantastic investigation about how the Houston Ship Channel is threatened and how scientists are predicting a 30-foot storm surge can wipe out the Houston Ship Channel. That took longer than expected. We're working with emerging technologies, and the challenge there was to recreate the 30-foot storm surge in virtual reality to give you an accurate sense of what a 30-foot wall of water looks like. I can say this over the air, you know, a wall of water 30 feet tall, but if I put you in that environment, an immersive environment, and you look up, you get that sense of scale. It took us about 9 months. To produce it actually took us about a month, but it was the challenge of computer graphics to do that. If we were going to do that now, we would be doing it much, much faster. This technology evolves and becomes easier and thankfully cheaper and quicker to produce. So my students can crank out 360 video pieces within a day. We covered the Trump inauguration and the March on Washington, the Women's March on Washington, in partnership with the New York Times and later with NPR over a weekend. So we can turn these pieces around rather quickly.
You're listening to Up to Date. My guest, Robert Hernandez, will be speaking this Friday at TEDxKC. The event begins at 6 in the evening. The Kauffman Center is sold out, but tickets for watch parties are still available, or you can catch the live stream. For more information, go to TEDxKC.org. You know, collaboration is something you foster in your students, Robert, and one way to encourage, you know, use of the web here. What kind of collaboration do you envision and between whom going forward?
Oh, this, if this technology plays out as many of us expect, this is going to be like a camera on your phone. So we can see collaborations of every aspect, from user-generated content, like capturing what happened in Charlottesville in 360 in real time. There's Periscope in 360, Facebook in 360. So you can see all perspectives, 360 degrees, as simple as someone using their phone or a little camera that costs less than $200, to high-end collaborations where there are new tech companies that are working with journalism production companies that are doing documentaries. One is Emblematic Group, and they worked with a startup company called 8i here in Santa Monica and Los Angeles, and they produced a piece called After Solitary, which use this incredible technology called photogrammetry and videogrammetry to scan a solitary confinement cell and make a 3D model, an accurate photo, realistic. It's not an artist interpretation. It is the cell in a 3D model. And then they scanned and interviewed Kenny, who was an inmate of the cell, and combined those two elements together. That's a really fascinating collaboration between tech and journalism coming together. And of course, the collaborations that my students try to do with media partners like New York Times and others.
How far away are we from seeing this kind of, extra kind of coverage of stories through virtual reality, augmented reality, as a daily part of our news consumption? I know the New York Times is doing it. Is it going to be the big mainstream media leaders like the Times and the Wall Street Journal that take the lead here, and then more middle America mainstream outlets like the Kansas City Star coming along in a few years? Or how do you see this playing out?
Definitely the New York Times has played an incredible role in rolling it out. They gave out over 1 million Google Cardboards when they launched their New York Times VR app with a documentary called The Displaced. And it was really took the industry forward. I don't have a timeline on when exactly this will go mainstream. I would say that it's sooner than we think. There's a couple factors that really make that possible, at least for immersive 360 video, which is very accessible to news companies and to an average person. The two factors I look at is that their cameras are more affordable. Like I said, there's a decent one that's under $200. But also Facebook bought Oculus Rift. Everyone knows Oculus Rift as a leading head-mounted display for virtual reality. They bought Oculus Rift, and of course they want 360 and immersive content to be consumed where? On Facebook. So you're probably seeing more panoramic images converted into 360-like immersive experiences in your Facebook feed right now. And that will only increase.
Is that going to change the kind of computer system I want at my home so I can sit back in the evening and look at my Facebook feed and really immerse myself in the experiences you're trying to put forward here?
Well, that is certainly what some of the tech sector wants. My goal as a journalist, right? So I get to play with this technology, but I'm a journalist first. So my goal as a journalist is to reach as many people as possible. I'm trying to inform my community. So while there are really expensive computers and head-mounted displays that you could get for extremely fantastic experiences, I can still reach you in immersive experiences through your smartphone now. We function in a world where we're a mobile-first society. You live and die by your cell phone. So I'm taking advantage of that relationship you have with your mobile device and trying to take advantage of the features there to offer you these immersive experiences. But of course, down the road, you know, we never would have thought that we would have broadband and high-end computers just so we can watch Game of Thrones or something like that. Mm-hmm. But you can upgrade, and it's pretty jaw-dropping. To experience something in Oculus Rift or the HTC Vive or the Sony PlayStation VR set. Really fantastic stuff.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there are technologies out there, Robert, that journalists are overlooking or not taking full advantage of right now.
Well, you know, that's actually my specialty in my job. I get to nerd out for a living in the name of journalism. Uh-huh. So I get to play with this stuff. And more importantly, I get to empower my students to not only explore and play with this stuff, but really define and maybe develop the first drafts of journalism there. So a lot of these things in the spectrum, you know, we might know of social media and mobile, of course, and drones are starting to become more in the mainstream. But there are things like sensors and using sensors to generate data so we can monitor air pollution or water pollution or noise pollution. And the stuff that I'm working on with my students now is under the umbrella of immersive storytelling, which is augmented reality, virtual reality, or the umbrella term of mixed reality. Lots of stuff, lots of innovation happening in so many fronts, not to mention Siri and Alexa. Hopefully I didn't set off anyone's Amazon Echo there, but those are the things that are in our wheelhouse. I tell people we live in the future, and I think journalism and journalists really need to take advantage of that to stay relevant in informing our communities.
Robert Hernandez is my guest. He's an associate professor of professional practice at USC Annenberg. We're talking about new ways to present information through American journalism that are very much on the horizon here and creeping closer every day. You've said that being where you are now as a professor at this time is where you like to be because it's exciting and disruptive. What do you like about that when it comes to the disruptive part?
Well, my entire career has been in digital journalism. When I was an undergrad student, my goal was to be a print reporter, but I took a coding multimedia class at San Francisco State University. I have to give them a shout out, go Gators. And I found that this new platform was yet to be defined, multimedia storytelling, using digital code, design, interactivity. Really is a playbook that has not been – there are no best practices when I first started. And I get to now live in that space with my job here where I don't have to worry, thankfully, about the ROI of an ad or click rates or traffic. I get to focus on trying to create journalistic experiences to inform my community by a variety of new technologies. Many and most of these technologies are never thought about in terms of through a journalistic lens. So I get to play with these things and, again, learn from my students as they bring a perspective I don't have, and we collaborate on how this can shape and advance journalism.
You know, I'm so struck by how fast technology is changing here and this challenge of how journalists are going to be able to keep doing their jobs and learn this new technology. How do you teach your students to keep learning after they leave the university so that they don't fall behind?
Great question. That's actually the framework of how we teach here. We teach our students to be curious and to problem solve. That's essential for reporting as well. If you're interviewing a source and the source says no, your interview and your reporting doesn't stop. You have to problem solve. You have to be creative on how you can get information. And that's really very much digital culture. You're trying to achieve a goal, a task. For us, it's journalism. What tools in your toolbox, your ever-growing, constantly evolving toolbox, can you use to achieve that goal? And our goal is still very simple, to inform our community, right? That is our job as the fourth estate, holding people accountable and informing our community so they can make better democratic decisions. So these are just tools, and we treat them as such. So Twitter is a thing right now. Who knows if it'll last forever, same as Facebook. But these are tools that we train our journalists to use so they can do better journalism. And it's a sense of curiosity that every journalist needs to have to not be complacent with how things were and lean into the next disruption. Use your phone, use social media, mm-hmm. use that camera, use that 360 camera or VR, whatever acronym will come out from the future. Really use it for the mission, which is inform our community.
So given all this, Robert, what do you see as the greatest challenge that young journalists face these days?
Well, I'll be frank with you, Steve. With our graduating students, the biggest challenge is going into a newsroom where the culture hasn't embraced the new modern development.
Yes, I can appreciate that.
Now, that said, what our school – and again, you know, well, you're at a university and you're proud of yours as I'm proud of mine. But I will say one of the things I'm most proud of is that these students, and including your students, they're change agents changing and advancing the culture in the newsrooms they go join. And depending on management there, they're going to be embraced and empowered, or they're going to be shut out. And if they're shut out, hopefully they move to a more progressive newsroom rather than leave our industry. But that's the biggest challenge. And I'm seeing more and more, you know, a lot of things. I'm almost been here 10 years, and I've seen the embracing of these students and embracing of this disruption in technology in our industry, which is really refreshing. So I see that as the biggest challenge, but it's working. Changes are being made, and evolution is happening, not only in technology, but in our newsrooms, in our embracing of our digital culture, in our journalistic culture.
You know, revenue continues to be a huge worry for journalism everywhere. How can technology help out here as news organizations still have to meet expenses, but people are becoming less inclined to pay for the news they consume?
That is the big challenge, and that's probably the first question I get whenever I talk about a new technology. But when I talk about a new technology, I'm also talking about a new opportunity. How can we monetize, say, immersive stories? Well, there is an infrastructure there. People are paying for immersive games or movies. If we can create an immersive experience that happens to be journalistic, people might pay for that. Maybe it's an app. Maybe it's an experience. Maybe it's we're creating immersive content that happens to be sponsored, or it's underwriting for journalism. Journalism that may not generate a lot of clicks or what have you, but it's essential for our democratic society. There's going to be a company that supports that mission. I think that that's becoming clear. But we need to experiment. We need to try to practice and experiment and innovate, which also includes failure.
Right.
And that's actually what I think my job is. I've come with the lens of I'm the research and development for the journalism industry. My students and I are experimenting and failing and learning and sharing all that with the industry as best we can so they can get a head start and maybe make some money off this new technology.
You know, as a lifelong journalist, I find what you have to say here, Robert, just absolutely fascinating. Robert Hernandez is an associate professor of professional practice at USC Annenberg. He's one of the presenters at this Friday's TEDxKC. The conference starts at 6 in the evening. More information, TEDxKC.org. And I should point out, Robert joined us by Skype here. And Robert Hernandez, thanks so much, and we'll look forward to seeing you here in Kansas City.
Thank you.
Preseason football has kicked off around the NFL, and the Kansas City Chiefs are beginning the process of settling on a roster. This year, that process includes deciding who will be the team's backup quarterback, and this year, the selection is particularly fraught, especially for a position that will likely see limited playing time. Sports reporter Greg Eklund is here to explain why, and Greg, always good to have you here.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, the Chiefs obviously drafted Pat Mahomes last spring, 10th overall, to much fanfare. His raw talent was attractive to scouts, but there's a bigger picture here. You say his selection got the Chiefs off the hook when it came to Colin Kaepernick. Explain that one for us.
Well, first, we should probably refresh our listeners as to the whole controversy surrounding Colin Kaepernick.
Mm-hmm.
He brought a lot of attention to himself and to the San Francisco 49ers when he chose to kneel during the national anthem last year in order to raise the issue of police brutality and racial injustice. Consequently, the 49ers cut him loose. So the big controversy around the NFL and around the country is the fact that he remains unsigned at this point of the preseason leading into the NFL's regular season. Now, getting back to how this affects the Chiefs, I tell you that they're off the hook because Pat Mahomes yesterday was named the number two quarterback for
That's
the Chiefs.
Right.
So right then and there, you have a backup quarterback to Alex Smith. Alex Smith is the starter, and Mahomes at this point, because it's a natural progression, the Chiefs named him yesterday after the preseason performance on Friday night. They've elevated him to this second status.
You know, so a lot depends on whether Mahomes get that second string spot, because if he doesn't wind up with it when the season begins, the question becomes, why didn't the Chiefs pick up Kaepernick? Right.
Yeah. Right. And that's a legitimate question. There are two reasons for That question to be asked, Steve, one, because the Chiefs went into camp with no veteran backup. As we know, because of what you had mentioned, Mahomes was drafted as a rookie. Tim Bray has never played a down in the NFL, and he's been with the Chiefs for four seasons now. And the Chiefs had Nick Foles last year as their backup, a capable backup, as he showed in the Indianapolis game when Alex Smith got hurt. So that raised the whole question with no veteran backup and possibly Mahomes not being a number two quarterback. That raises the question, you know, why haven't the Chiefs? And Clark Hunt came out around the time the training camp opened. He did an interview with NBC Sports, and he was quoted in that interview by saying that the Chiefs would not hesitate to sign Kaepernick if that situation arose.
You know, the Chiefs haven't shied away from controversial players, Greg, in the past. I mean, but there are some exceptions there, too.
There are some exceptions. I mean, we've been around the controversial subjects of Tyreek Hill and Michael Vick more recently. Michael Vick is at training camp now at the invitation of Coach Andy Reid. We know his track record in the past. He served his time, 18 months, in prison for financing a dogfighting ring. He's trying to get his life back in order. So under the NFL coaching internship, he's with the Chiefs right now, which of course has raised concerns among animal rights activists. In the other situation that the Chiefs didn't shy away from controversy was Tyreek Hill last year. Mm-hmm. They drafted him fully knowing the history of domestic violence that he had. And Tyreek Hill produced on the field for the Chiefs. There are a lot of expectations this season for Tyreek Hill on the Chiefs. In the meantime, off the field, publicly, he has kept himself clean, although there is a situation still unresolved in the state of Oklahoma where a case for financially supporting the mother of his son is still pending.
Hmm. Well, Patrick Mahomes was kind of a surprise pick in the first place, Greg. You say he's also kind of symbolic for the success or possible failure of the Big 12. Explain that one to us.
The Big 12 really is trying to be relevant on the college national football picture right now, particularly when it comes to the college football playoff. Oklahoma is the only team that has represented the Big 12 in the college football playoff so far.
So some concern the Big 12 has fallen off a little bit.
Absolutely a concern. Evidence when you look at the draft picks from last spring, the Big 12 only had 14 of their players from the conference picked in the NFL draft. Compare that to the SEC, which had more than 50, or the ACC, which had more than 40. So there is a big, or at least by NFL draft standards, has been a big drop-off in the talent level in the Big 12, and the Big 12 conference is trying to become relevant again on the major college football scene, and part of that is getting its players drafted into the NFL.
Hmm. Well, just change gears here. You say this is going to be a big fall season in Kansas City for women's volleyball. Let's talk about women's volleyball, because we don't often talk about women's volleyball. Why is that?
Well, because the volleyball Final Four is going to be in Kansas City in December.
Oh, really?
It is. At Sprint Center for the first time since 2010.
It's a great sport.
It is a great sport.
So much
Very
fun to watch.
Very entertaining to watch.
Yeah.
And there are some great matches in the non-conference schedule that'll be starting at the end of this month. Unlike football, when you have your softened schedules like a Central Arkansas playing at Kansas State, the volleyball teams, especially the top-notch ones, don't shy away from going head-to-head against the other powerhouse teams. For instance, Texas, which is the preseason number one ranked team, is going to be playing two top 20 teams in the rankings on the first weekend of the year. So good head-to-head matchups around the country, and there's a good caliber of teams that will be vying for those Final Four spots in Kansas City in December.
Why is Kansas City the host for something like this?
Well, Kansas City, as I mentioned, hosted 7 years ago and did it very well.
Huh.
It's a great geographical location because there are really some powerhouse volleyball teams in this central time zone. When you go beyond, I had already mentioned Texas down there in Austin, but Nebraska just up the road. I mean, Nebraska is always a powerhouse team. They won in Omaha a couple of years ago. Further up the road, Minnesota. Minnesota's going to be a great team this year. I mean, the Big Ten Conference with those two teams. And the team that won was another Big Ten team, Penn State, when they were here 7 years ago. So there are a lot of great college volleyball programs in this. And I can't leave out Creighton. They beat out KU. And KU, they're ranked number 8 this year.
Wow. That's sports reporter Greg Eklund giving us a sports update here. Thanks so much, Greg.
You're
always
welcome,
appreciate
Steve.
It.
All righty.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, how ancient teachings and neuroscience can work together and what we can learn from our effort to have it all. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produce our show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.